just to sort of, I want to offer, like, toss out a little bit of historical framing, because I think it's interesting, is that, you know, if you look at the very first weekend that Americans could pay to see movies, it was in 1894 when this, you know, Thomas Edison opened up a kinetoscope parlor in Manhattan. And, you know, before then, everything was just live entertainment, theater, and opera. And in that first weekend, the movies took in $120. And so I think you could have looked at that and said, like, gosh, this is such a small business. Like, look at, you know, yeah. vaudeville and opera make so much more money in one night. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that it's interesting from a business standpoint to look at digital now and say, oh, it's just kind of small dollar value, and kind of write it off and just keep doing what we're doing, which is like selling to TV and selling DVDs and, you know, selling to cable and whatever. And just ignore digital. But then I do think that there are going to be a lot of people that look at digital and say, oh, this is really small right now, but, you know, you're going to be able to put something on YouTube or iTunes and you know, figure out how to make some significant money.
Actually, Susie, I'm curious to know where the money for the Harvard project is coming from.
At the moment, a very traditional source, National Endowment for the Humanities, which has a new digital media initiative that they're looking for pilot and new ideas. So it's a pilot project, yeah. And they had funded the original film, so.
Jim, do you want to introduce yourself real quickly, since we already went around and did it?
Sure. Hi, I'm Jim Flynn. I'm CEO of a company called Easy Pigs, and we're a movie download service.
What's the name of the company again?
It's called Easy Takes. Letter E, letter Z, T-A-K-E-S.
Well, just to pick up on the NEH, I know, is really, really into digital media initiatives now. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me they don't really want to consider anything anymore unless it has that component. Mm-hmm. They're really trying to drive things in that direction. So people really have to start embracing this.
You know, we talked about monetization. There's one very, very easy place to start. And that's Google Ads. Mm-hmm. You know, every once in a while I get a check for $100 or $200 mm-hmm. just for my own blog, mm-hmm. which, you know, doesn't.
Sure.
I can say I've kind of monetized these little 2 and 3 minute films I've made is one way to look at it. Mm-hmm. And the more traffic you drive to your site, you know, the more ad revenue you get. And the thing about Google Ads is they're contextual. So, like, for example, when you go to my blog, there's a lot of ads for the Panasonic HVX200 because I've done a lot of blog posts on that camera. So they're actually useful, and they're contextual, mm-hmm. and they're very subtle. You can put them off to the side. They don't blink. They don't flash. They don't, you like, put up pop-ups. And the more traffic you drive to your site, you know, that's one revenue stream. And I think what filmmakers need to think about is it's not about monetizing one thing, but it's about, you know, thinking of this thing as a platform where there's different ways to monetize different aspects mm-hmm. of your work.
Yeah.
You know, like at DIY Days, Laura Teodosio was talking about her short film that she actually got several festivals actually paid her a screening fee, mm-hmm. for example. And that's just one revenue stream, you know. DVD sales, that's another revenue stream. Ad revenue online is yet another revenue stream. Download for pay is another revenue stream. Just kind of think of it as a sort of portfolio approach where any one method of monetization mm-hmm. isn't going to be a lot of money, but they start to add up. Mm-hmm. And it's also cumulative over time. Because I think something that came out of the DIY Days conference here in Boston recently was that filmmakers need to start thinking about building a relationship with their audience over time. This is not a, like as you were saying, Scott, it's not this one-shot thing. I submit film to festivals, I get awards, I make a lot of money selling DVD. You know, it's like, okay, it's not this one-time thing anymore. It's like, okay, I'm going to build a relationship over time with an audience, and this relationship over time, if I'm doing something that resonates with the audience, I'm going to start to build up some kind of revenue.
And I would add to that that it's not, you know, it's great to have those multiple business models, but I also think you need to think about having multiple products to fit each of those business mm-hmm. models. So mm-hmm. you know, in a way, you know, you can think about having some, you maybe have 10 little segments from your movie that work really well as like 3 or 4 minutes standalone, just a really interesting bit of an interview or kind of a you are there piece of a travelogue. And those are great things to monetize by having like a little ad that's shown before the video or after the video. You know, and then maybe you have like this super ultra long director's cut version that sells on a DVD for $50, and you know, you have the traditional theatrical version or the TV version. You have the download version that you sell on Easy Takes. And then the other thing I wanted to mention that came up at some of these ITVS Paley Center events was, you know, people worried about what's going to happen to the educational market and all those wonderful people that pay $250 or $300 for a DVD. And one thought was, you know, if you have all of this footage that you've produced that's much more than just a movie, and you were willing to allow an educational institution to say, I'm going to use some edit-it-yourself tool like, you know, an iSpot type tool or jump cut, I forget which one is still in business, but you know, to go online and say, all right, I'm going to pick the 30 minutes of footage that I want to show in my class and, you know, sell me that as a download or sell me that as a DVD, and maybe I'll keep paying a premium price if I can sort of edit this movie specifically for my class rather than just buying the DVD and having to like click around to all the different chapters that you want to you want to use.
And I think they want that. From the meeting I was just at, the customers are saying they do want that availability. Mm-hmm. But the pushback is that they still want a hard copy. Mm-hmm. The digital is, they're archivists.
Yeah.
So if they don't have a hard copy of a film, video, and they just have a digital file, that it's not floating for them.
Yeah.
That's how long it's going to be true.
Yeah, really.
Right.
That feels like a transition moment rather than a long-term business plan.
Right.
Yeah, I think for us, one of the reasons why we've stayed in business for 40 years is that we've done pretty much all of those things we've been talking about. We have a huge portfolio of over 900 titles, and for many of our filmmakers, they are producing a number of versions. They're producing their 90-minute plus festival version. They're producing their 60-minute a broadcast version, and then we're offering the DVD with all the extras for the educational market. Then we've got our streaming, low-cost streaming for direct-to-consumer sales, and also looking to develop new products too. And I think for us that iTunes University site where we're actually developing this parallel. We have our DER site where we're still selling products directly off that site. And this opportunity to set up this iTunes University site encouraged us to work more directly with our filmmakers, offering the opportunity to create such things as we have a section called Stories from the Field, where they can start when they have a film in production that we're working with them on finding funding for. They're putting up these little war stories, and we're hoping to encourage more and more of our filmmakers to take advantage of that as they move through their production, which then in turn helps to build that audience. It also is like an educational tool for other filmmakers. Look, this is what happened to me, you know, when I was out shooting so-and-so, or I had this horrific experience on this interview, and it can be anything, and we're hoping that it stimulates their creativity and again helps them to build an audience when they, you know, over that course of 2, 3, sometimes 4 or 5 years that they're working on these projects, trying to get them done. So.
And what's the monetization of that?
Well, I had a lot of resistance, even internally from my own staff, when Apple offered us this opportunity, you know, to create free content for them for their iTunes U site. And my staff is saying, why are we doing this? We're not getting any, they're not paying us to do that.
Yeah.
But I really saw it as a way to elevate our visibility
to a whole other group of people, those iPod cell phone people, to repurpose a lot of our stuff we're already offering free on our own website and put it in this different arena. Mm-hmm. And while iTunes U doesn't allow you to sell anything directly off your iTunes U site, you can have all kinds of links link back. Mm-hmm. So we tell our filmmakers, you give us a little short story, we'll link it back directly to our donor page for your film, to your website, and it's just another way to drive traffic all over the place. And and we've, you know, and then iTunes also provides us with a lot of statistical stuff that makes it very interesting to see who our new users are, how are they using the material, and mm-hmm. so it's been a very interesting. It's very new. I mean,
have you looked at the Open Television Network mechanism for monetizing RSS feeds? Have you seen this? Has anybody seen ClickTab? So Philip Hodgetts, who's well, excuse me.
Can we give it up on?
Yeah, just look. I would Google ClickTab, ClickTab. I forget the URL, but you know, Google can help us find it. So Open Television Network was started by several people, including Philip Hodgetts, who's well known in the Final Cut Pro community. And they've done a very low-key introduction. This is kind of, right now it's sort of like a word-of-mouth kind of thing. But it's trying to solve this problem, right? All these services, and of course iTunes being the 10,000 pound gorilla, they don't really want to make it, they don't make it easy for the little guy to get you know, monetized. But they do support RSS feeds of, like, video blogs or subscription material. So what ClickTab technology does, it allows you to provide content to your viewers through an RSS feed, through iTunes, but it allows you to put up previews, and then if they click to download on subsequent items, you can have free items, and then you could have paid items. So when they click to download a special coded RSS feed, it actually charges their account. So it's a way of charging for content that you make available as a free RSS feed subscription. But particular items they can click, when they say the click to download on iTunes. So basically what they wanted to do this end run around Apple not allowing the little guy to monetize. And several people who do, like, a lot of how-to videos have started using ClickTab technology as a way of charging, you know, 25 cents or 50 cents or a dollar per episode, because there is a great opportunity in that marketplace that people are willing to pay for content. And, you know, they've gotten off to a slow start, but they've got several clients. The tricky part, you know, just like PayPal had this exact same problem when they started, you have to give your credit card number to ClickTab so that they can charge you incrementally for content. But they start off giving you, I think, $5 or $10, you know, free content to start if you start up an account. And, you know, as of August, you know, they're still moving forward and they're trying to get ClickTab. I think it's opentelevisionnetwork.com.
So how do people, excuse me, how do people know about your feed if they have to pay for
you,
it?
You put the ClickTab link on your website.
But I mean, if...
presumably, like, you show up in iTunes, like, through searches, right? If somebody searched on, like, how to and, like, you know, karate or something, show up.
Right.
But you wouldn't be able to subscribe through iTunes.
So you can subscribe to the feed, but then you'll only get the free material. And if you want the paid material, if you click to download that, it's you have to have an account for it to actually give that to you. Yeah, it's explained with a really good demo movie on the Open Television Network.
I mean, the thing that is unfortunate is, like, you know, so many people that wanted to help monetize, help independent, you know, individual filmmakers monetize stuff. You know, Brightcove was talking about doing that for a while, and they never quite got there. And Google talked about doing it and never quite did it with Google Video. And iTunes is still so slow. Like, there are a couple companies that they seem to want to work with, like, you know, New Video and Docurama, I think they work with.
And yeah, only two aggregators they work with.
Yeah, I think the other one might be MediaStyle, which Sundance was having some issues with, you know, hearing from their filmmakers that payment wasn't actually happening, and so I'm not sure what's up with that other one.
As a distributor, we found, you know, it's interesting in working with the iTunes thing and trying to get a wedge in there, and that's why we found the iTunes U fit a lot of served a number of purposes for us, and iTunes made it also invited us with our 900 titles to start offering them through the iTunes store broadcast. But when we looked at the cost factor and the money side, it just wouldn't work for us. The upfront costs are astronomical.
You mean to digitize all of the content for iTunes?
Yeah. I mean, they would charge us a new video, or you have to go through an aggregator, no matter who you are, over $500 a title just to, you know, get it out, have them do their work with it. And then the percentages that they're offering you on downloads, on sales, not half as good as we were getting with Google, and not as good as we're getting with Amazon. Mm-hmm. So we do have...
And when you say Google, you mean you used to participate in that sort of Google video store that doesn't exist anymore?
Yeah, we were one of the first content providers over 2 years ago, mm-hmm. When Google was in its beta test for download to own. Mm-hmm. And we had, at the end of that experiment, we had over 500 full-length titles, anywhere from 10 minutes to 90 minutes, that we were selling. And our revenues were going up just incrementally every month. And in the last month of that experiment, before they killed it, our revenues from downloads went up 300% between March and April. That would have been a year and a half ago.
And so did those titles migrate somewhere else after Google shut down, or did those
no,
titles
just aren't
really...
No, we just took them all off. And since that time, we were looking for ways to duplicate that Google experience. I mean, there were some... We found Google very good to work with. The downside for us is we have a very big international market, and we couldn't... It wasn't accessible to our international customers. But that would solve a tremendous amount of problems for us if we could find a download system for full-length documentary film that was available internationally. But... Nobody's doing that.
Have any of the download-to-pay services gone international, like Kashi or your service?
We're international.
Okay.
In how many different countries?
We're selling in just about every country, but ones that we're... I don't think we sell in North Korea. We don't sell in some countries that have very high incidence of credit card fraud. I think a couple of the Baltic countries, Eastern European, not all of them. But just about everywhere else in the world, so almost everywhere.
We'd be interested in talking to you. Very
sure.
Interested.
I mean, I guess iTunes does have stores in a handful of other countries other than America, right? Mostly Europe?
We get probably about 35% of our sales outside the U.S., but the biggest countries, of course, are the English-speaking countries because of the content that we have, and so it would be Canada, the U.K., Australia, probably the biggest international countries, but we do also get sales from just about everywhere.
Do you allow your content providers to brand their content within the context of your site, or how does that work?
Yes, if a content provider signs up with us, they get their own section of our site, so they can link to all their titles on our site. Mm-hmm. And then we're also adding the capability to break it down by labels. So if there's sub-labels that somebody might, a distributor might have, then even those sub-labels will have their own section.
Yeah, because we've got a nice thing with Create Space on Amazon now that we're about ready to get our first check, so I'll know if it's been cost-effective or not.
We'll also be doing some other interesting things that I can't really talk about right now with being able to branch out to enabling rights holders to make sales from their own site as well, using our technology.
Cool.
Could you talk
about how an independent producer might approach you, or how does that work? Who approaches you to provide the content?
We do get approached all the time, and I'm sort of ashamed to say that we turn away a lot of independent producers. And it's simply a mathematics thing right now, because in most cases, the independent producer would come to us, and if I get a red line distribution agreement for one title and then it goes online, you know, the minute I have to look at a red line, I've lost money on it. Usually, not all the time. There are some notable exceptions to it. So it's really hard for an independent producer unless we see a built-in market for the type of content that they're coming to us with. One exception we made was for a company called Cinematic Titanic, which was started by a guy named Joel Hodgson, played Joel Robinson on Mystery Science Theater 3000, and brought all those Mystery Science Theater people together again to create a new company. They took a very, I guess for lack of a better term, a holistic approach to distributing their content, and included theatrical, DVD distribution, as well as online distribution was a big part of it. And we've had just massive amount of sales of their stuff. And a lot of the reason for that is that they're exclusively on our site for download. And then on top of that, they had that built-in market of fans that they also asked, the fans asked themselves, well, could I just order the DVD or should I download it from Easy Takes? The fans are so crazy about the content that they didn't want to wait an extra week to get the DVD, so there's a very high percentage of downloads of that content. But I think I heard a few people say that before, that that there's a lot of different revenue streams, and I would definitely recommend that you have to. And a lot of times they actually feed off one another, too. If you give away content for free online, you'll probably increase your DVD sales. A lot of times it's very hard for somebody that maybe sold a kidney to make a film to sort of let go of that and take those chances.
Anthony, could you talk a little bit about the meeting that you attended?
It was at the National Media Market in Lexington. It was in September. Gary Handman at the University of California, Berkeley, runs the media department, and Larry DeRosa from California Newsreel had done a white paper on digital download and sort of the state of distribution, customers looking at it. And in a nutshell, it's a lot of frustration. I think customers are, there's no standardization of the form, of the way the content's getting to them. So it was a frustrating meeting because in the end, I didn't take a lot away from it. I wish there was more. There is a white on the website, you can look at it, the white paper. What else can I report from that?
On the Fanlight website?
No, on the Media Market website.
Website.
I actually have a copy of it. If I can pass it around if people want to look at it. It's hard. I think the transition. A lot of the old school filmmakers that started talking about the transition from 16 millimeter to DVD and sort of recreating that atmosphere right now, and that's what's going on. So, from a lot of distributors' point of view, they're just sort of, it was a wait and see. They're not willing to take the risk for digital download, giving it away for free. So, but it's exciting to hear that it's working for you guys.
Yeah. I think it's a big mistake, and I've been on panels with other my colleagues and Bullfrog Films and Filmmakers Library, and where there is this anxiety and fear and a protectionist, I would call it, approach. And I think what's going to happen is they're going to be left in the dust. And you have to take risks. You know, you can't think that you're not going to go into it until you've figured out all the ins and outs and all the answers. Because part of it is experimenting, seeing what works. If it doesn't work, you stop doing it. You know, I mean, it seems simple to me. And
I hate to draw too many historical parallels, but if you look at the early days of television, I mean, most of the producers of film, the big producers of film, sort of sat on the sidelines and said, oh, there isn't enough of a business here, television can't pay enough to run our movies. And then you had a few people like Walt Disney saying, like, you know, what could I produce for this new channel, you know, and how can you make money promoting your films through it? And, you know, I mean, how much did the studios lose in those 5 or 10 years of saying, no, we're not going to sell our movies to television because it's too small?
One question that comes up a lot with my filmmakers is the rights issue. They haven't necessarily negotiated the rights to distribute online. So, and they barely have enough money to make their films. So what do you do about that?
Well, that's a really good point. We have to, this isn't just about distribution and technology. It's about rethinking the whole intellectual property law perspective of the content we produce. I mean, you know, I've started including in my release forms that the material may be released under Creative Commons share alike license, because somebody might be okay with me using their interview, but would they be happy with somebody else repurposing that interview? Mm-hmm. And to be upfront that not only are you giving me the right to do this, but I want to be crystal clear, even though most releases are written that give you the right to do that, but to be crystal clear from a human social relationship perspective, that this might be repurposed and recut mercilessly by somebody else who I have no control over. It's not just that I'm giving them somebody else the rights to the film.
Yeah, but at least you have control over that. I'm talking about third party. I'm talking about...
Right. No, I'm just saying that as an example, but we have to start thinking about...
That's a great example when you can have that control. But filmmakers are paying so much now just for stock footage rights to factor in online distribution rights also is just... putting them over the top.
But it's a huge issue.
Yes, and it's so much up in the air, too, that a lot of people that own it, they don't really want to give it away as far as, you know, they can't really put a definition around how to allow these, you know, like the back end sound and stuff like that, how to allow it to be distributed online. Because they're afraid that, okay, if we give it to them and it goes out there, somebody else is just going to pull it down, and there you go.
That's
so the whole online thing is scary to a lot of distributors for that.
The rights, in terms of the rights and purchasing the rights, the customers are frustrated that they have to keep renewing a license. Mm-hmm. They think that that's a really foul way of playing, because that's the idea of buying a DVD. It's theirs for the life of the DVD. But when you're buying a digital file, and you have to pay rights again in 3 years for that same file, it seems crazy to them. They don't understand that. So
there's a tremendous amount of fear just to leverage off what you were saying. And I was on the phone with a distributor, a real prestigious small company, well-known but very old school, and were afraid that if they put their content out there that it would get copied. Mm-hmm. So I was on the phone with them and I said, well, what's your most valuable title that you have right now? Are you in front of a Google? And I said, type in that title followed by the word torrent. And there's something like 15, 20,000 hits on it. Pirate Bay, ISOHON, Sumo Torrent, you name it, it's already being distributed worldwide for free. So putting it online somewhere else is definitely not going to increase the exposure, because anyone in the world in front of a computer is a mouse click away from getting it anyway.
Well, and I think that brings up the issue of this is about building a relationship with your audience, because fans are going to be really happy to buy your DVD. You know, I noticed like with the DIY Days conference, the videos are on, you know, were put online, you know, and you could watch them for free. And at the conference, people were very happy to make a $20, $30 donation for the hard copy, quote unquote, DVD as a way of helping the conference, for example. So I think the problem is that with the industrialization of the industry, we started thinking of, you know, DVDs as this commodity that's sold on a store shelf. And I think filmmakers have this great opportunity to rethink the whole ecosystem as I'm building a relationship with my audience, my viewers. And they want me to do more work. They want to support what I'm doing. And so I'm going to give them various ways that they can provide support, whether it be buying DVDs or buying T-shirts or contributing to the production of the next project. I know some independent filmmakers, for example, have sold individual frames of their animation. as a way of raising money for their film, which makes for really long credit rolls at the end, you know, where you have the frame number range and the person who paid for that part of the film. But, you know, I think the challenge is to think more creatively about our relationship with the marketplace as it is. And I believe philosophically that giving stuff away is a wonderful way to build a relationship with people. In fact, you know, many years ago I started pre-production on a film about intellectual property issues and the value of giving stuff away for free. And I decided that it was going to be the most dreadfully boring documentary and no one would ever watch it. And so I killed the project the moment that a friend of mine, Bren Bataclan, invited me to his first art opening. And here it was an emerging artist who was showing his work in a gallery. All of the paintings had a price tag attached to them. My wife and I purchased painting number one of exhibition number one. And lo and behold, since that first gallery exhibition, Bren Bataclan has become a self-supporting artist by giving his paintings away, and that's what my film Smile Boston Project is about. And the more Bren gives away his paintings, the more commissions he gets, the more grants he gets, the more gallery showing invitation he gets, the more he gives it away, the more successful he is. And in some ways, he is sort of this living, breathing example of the Google economy. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about it, Google gives away 80% of their wealth, of the wealth that they've created in terms of intellectual property, in terms of information. But by giving 80% of it away, and that's just a number I'm throwing out there, they're able to monetize that 20%, right? Mm-hmm. So they're making a fortune in the ad business, and they're giving it away in the information retrieval search business. Mm-hmm. But that 80% they give away creates that market. And in a way, the more you give away, you create a space for yourself. For example, Bren Bataclan kind of owns the category of giving away happy, smiley paintings. He's kind of created this category, and he owns that category. And so by giving stuff away, he creates a niche for himself. And I think, and so I made the documentary to share it with artists and filmmakers, so to help them think about how this might work for them. And you know, Bren is a good business person. He worked as a management consultant and a designer in previous lives, so he understood the new economy business models really well intuitively. And so for him, it was very natural. And he came about it very innocently. It was never this, you know, evil corporate plan or anything like that, you know, to monetize his work. In some ways, he kind of stumbled across a model, but he was able to recognize it, and he was able to nurture it and feed it. So I think there's a lot of other examples like that. Another example I think that's interesting to look at online is the show with Zay Frank. Zay Frank was a video blogger who made a video blog for exactly 1 year. But what was interesting about Zay Frank is he didn't just do a video blog. He built a relationship with his audience. He would involve his viewers in the process of future shows. He incorporated viewer submissions as part of his video blog. And he would do really wonderful participatory projects. He did this one project called Earth Sandwich. Somebody would take a piece of bread, they'd put it down on the ground somewhere on the planet, and share the GPS coordinates. Now the challenge was somebody else had to find the opposite spot on the Earth and put a piece of bread on that opposite side of the planet. And there were actually some people crazy enough to go out of their way in their, you know, exotic world travels and put a piece of bread down on the ground so that they could make an Earth sandwich. And it's this kind of inventiveness of building dialogue with the audience, you know, and moving away from a broadcast model of I am the author and I send things out into the world to I am a master of ceremonies, or I'm a collaborator, or I'm a leader, or I'm a member of a community, and I'm bringing people together to do things collaboratively as a group.
I love that idea. A lot of the films that filmmakers are building these almost outreach type media campaigns around are the ones that do well. They do really well. But maybe 1 in 10 that comes to me is a filmmaker that wants to keep working on this and hasn't, mm-hmm. you know, the other 9 have moved on. Mm-hmm. They've made their film, now they're working on their next film. And
yeah. Well, the thing, so it's rethinking that. But Zay Frank did it for 1 year.
Yeah.
And that's why I use that example, because he did it for a fixed time. right? Because I hear that objection from a lot of my fellow filmmakers.
I
don't want to be a marketing person for the rest of my life. I'm a filmmaker. I want to make films, not marketing campaigns.
Well, of course, say Frank's day job is marketing, so he's brilliant. But he also has a separate traditional monetization stream.
Not that
that argues against it, but it's just that he's not making money from Earth Sandwich, just to be clear.
And of course, his episode on brand is the best explanation of brand I've ever seen. In one sentence, he summarizes brand as an emotional aftertaste. He is a brilliant marketer.
On the marketing front, I'm trying to remember what the percentages were, but Lyda, I don't know if you remember Tiffany Schlein when she was at the conversation you know, of the money that she raises for a short film or a full-length feature, I feel like she said it was half and half. Like, half goes to the production budget and half goes to, like, marketing and distribution.
Yeah, or even less. I mean, now it's starting, you know, like, that the marketing would be more of her budget, probably.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly is spending a lot of her time on it. And, you know, she's one of the few examples of someone who figured out a way to get her short film, The Tribe, onto iTunes. And for a while last year, it was, like, the number one selling short on iTunes, you know, outselling, you know, Pixar's latest shorts.
And I'm glad that Tiffany Schlein is out there saying that, you know, because I remember when I worked in film post-production in New York, I would talk to a lot of independent filmmakers about their budget. We always had this budget conversation because they were coming to me, you know, to figure out how much is the 16 to 35 millimeter blow-up going to cost. And the number one thing I used to always say is, how much are you setting aside for marketing and promotion of your film? Zero. You know, they all had this dream that if they just got into Sundance, everything would take care of itself. And I go, boy, you know, I don't think you should spend $40,000 on a 35mm blow-up if you're not going to also spend $40,000 on getting the film out there, because you're going to have this beautiful 35mm print, and this was at the time when you had to have a 35mm print, but if no one sees it, you know, if you're going to spend $40,000 for one festival, you know, what are you going to do after that? You know, and what's wonderful now is I hope more filmmakers start. You know, Schlein's example is a really good one to think about the holistic picture, that it's about art, and it's about
getting your art seen, right?
You know, because especially if you know all these postmodern structuralist theories, if the art is in the reception, you better find some viewers out there, otherwise maybe the art won't even exist in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I actually talked to, for the ITVS project, which is, I think, now on their website, and I forget what they've termed it, but it's like a report from the field or something. And, you know, I talked to filmmakers who would hire someone off of Craigslist and pay them like $9 or $10 an hour to just sit around and go look at blogs that related to this film. And so, you know, one example was with King Korn, you know, looking for food and agriculture blogs that, you know, would post a clip from the film or would do an email interview with the filmmakers or, like, something to get that little blog audience of, you know, whatever, it might just be 500 or 1,000 people that read that blog. But, you know, some person at $10 an hour hired off Craigslist, you know, maybe spends 2 hours communicating with the owner of that blog and, you know, sending them some production stills and, you know, whatever else they want. It seemed like it was, you know, can be a pretty effective strategy.
Cynthia, how are things going with Reframe?
Well, that's the Amazon thing I refer to, and they're cutting their first checks this week, so I'll let you know. Give me a call next week when we see the check.
So you have no way of seeing, they don't have a stats thing that you can access and see? Or?
Yeah, I think I have a tech department that the tech guys are in touch with them.
Can look at it.
As far as the actual money we're making,
you don't know yet.
Like I said, they're cutting the checks this week. So.
And when you said iTunes didn't make sense financially, are they not doing a 70-30 split for the films like they are for other stuff?
No, I forget the exact percentages, and of course the pricing is much lower than what we were getting with Google,
because
too. We were getting a better split with Google, and then there's the upfront costs. And for a distributor, you know, if we're talking about 400, 500, 600 films at $500 a pop,
right?
You know.
So with Google, you were setting your own educational price, and with iTunes, they're managing.
Yeah, with Google, we could, because Google didn't know what they were doing then either. Right. So, you know, and so we had a lot of needs because of our having to pay royalties to our filmmakers in the reporting end, on the back end. And we had no idea what we were going to charge, so we picked some numbers out of the hat, and they went along with everything we asked. It was very much a kind of, okay, we'll do that, and we'll try this, but ultimately, in the end, when Google saw that it wasn't making money for Google, and I could understand it because they told us that their two biggest revenue streams were coming from us and Charlie Rose. So I figured, wow, you know, if it's DER and Charlie Rose on Google, I can understand why they pulled it.
So. Jim, I'm curious if that makes sense to you, sort of the like $500 a film encoding cost to get something in digital form. Like, do you charge that too?
Well, I'm feeling like a real dope here because we don't charge anything for encoding. As long as somebody gives us a decent catalog of films, meaning usually 20 or more, we don't charge anything for it. I think just one thing to address your question before, what I foresee in the future, and we don't do it right now because, as I mentioned, it's just a financial part of it, that you'll see functionality where sites will be able to give independent filmmakers, individual filmmakers, self-service functionality. And it's something we'd like to do in the future where you might go to a website and maybe you'll get charged a little bit up front just to put your stuff online. I don't think $500, but you know, some sort of minimum where it could be completely self-service and go through and publish yourself. Potentially end up on your own private site or maybe even apply to get into an online catalog. But I think there was some services doing it.
CreateSpace does do that now. You know, they're a division of Amazon, and you know, if you have just a movie, you can give it to them, I think, with no upfront charges, and they'll either sell it as a DVD that gets printed on demand, or they'll sell it through Amazon's video on demand service.
So I think you'll see more and more of that.
Yeah.
And you might not see it from iTunes. I sense that iTunes just doesn't want people tripping over the titles that they're going to be selling in bulk and many cases, so they spend all their time on that.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, like, I just have a philosophical issue with Apple selling all of this technology to filmmakers, you know, whether it's Final Cut or the laptop or, you know, the iPhone that they use, and then, like, nope, you can't come into our marketplace, you know?
But it took a while, too, with like, audio. I mean, now pretty much anyone can get their audio on iTunes, and I think video is a much tougher market for them, and that's why they're really resistant to kind of cluttering up the store. And they're forcing people to go through these monopoly aggregates.
I can only guess what they're doing, but it's probably just somebody sitting there with a spreadsheet saying, yeah, we can add this functionality, but we've got other priorities right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, even I think their music is not self-service either, right? But it's almost self-service.
Right, you go to CD Baby and
it's like $15. Yeah. But I think the video market for them is... You know, there are free video podcasts. They're dealing with like rentals, which you don't have to deal with music. And I think they're really worried about the perception of scaring off Hollywood, because they're already having trouble with like HD movies and some movies that you can't rent. They're really trying to present this consistent experience.
What do you mean having trouble with HD movies?
I would theorize that the reason that you need an Apple TV to do an HD rental of a movie is because of the concern of the studios having HD in the iTunes DRM on a computer. So you can only rent HD movies if you have an Apple TV, which is kind of like a lot harder to get the content off of than a regular Mac.
Well, it's going to reduce their market from a few hundred million to a few thousand.
Right. Yeah, Apple have another problem, that Apple TV has very low numbers compared to Netflix, who I think is the quiet giant here, as soon as they, at any moment, they could turn on the floodgates and kind of own that online network-based movie rental business.
Yeah, but they're having the same issues, and that they, you know, it's the content experience is really inconsistent. Like on iTunes, there are movies that you can only buy, because the studio's like, well, if we're getting $15, Right,
they don't
care.
But Apple's model is dependent on buying this box, whereas Netflix could work with, you know, everyone's PC and laptop.
Yeah. So I mean, the Netflix thing is...
iTunes, too.
It's hard to think about how Netflix will work, because I don't know how they... would they pay filmmakers or distributors for the rights to stream that movie, like how that deal works. But, you know, in a way, I think a lot of what that Netflix streaming is going to be used for in the next year or two is like for someone to sort of sample a movie and watch the first 10 minutes and decide, you know, maybe if they want to watch the whole movie, they'll just add it to their Netflix queue and then rent it. So, you know, in theory, that makes Netflix buy more copies of your DVD to sort of satisfy that demand. But I wonder, David, as it shifts over to like just purely viewing it on the computer or viewing it on the TV, if the business deal is going to be, you know, favorable for filmmakers.
The Netflix's challenges for them to get to the TV through digital distribution is they're going to have to rely on somebody else.
Yeah, they're starting to partner with TiVo.
TiVo, and then what is Netflix in that case? Well, they're a website where maybe somebody could order stuff.
Yeah.
But TiVo completely controls the distribution of that. And if TiVo wants to deliver Spider-Man from somebody else, they can switch out Netflix.
But Jim, I was at Netflix last month, and like their whole business is totally now about building that service into like any new piece of electronics equipment. So like any new TV, any new DVD player, you know, there are now you can go buy a Blu-ray player that has built-in, you know, Netflix.
Yeah, they have tremendous amount of clout, but I see that if I was in their shoes, I'd be very worried about how I'm going to control the distribution channel and how TiVo can go right to the content owners at some point and say, why do you need Netflix?
Yeah.
So it's a lot of their value right now is their whole logistics, their delivery channel, which they won't control when they go to digital. And I think another area that is not talked about much are game consoles. If you look at the number of TiVos out there that are internet-enabled, compared to game consoles, it's a handful. There may be a few million TiVos that can get broadband content. But there's something, I'll give wrong statistics because I'm going back to like June, but something like 14 million PlayStation 3s. There's more Xboxes and there's a lot more Wiis in that, out there.
Mm-hmm. And that PlayStation,
that are connected to TVs.
Yeah, that new PlayStation is a really nice Blu-ray player.
Yeah, if you want to buy a PlayStation, I have a PlayStation at home, and it's for $400, it's a Blu-ray player. I've loaded Linux on it, so it's a general-purpose computer, and it's a game console. And now they're doing a lot in terms of supporting things like the Digital Living Room Network Alliance, so that you can network the content you have on a computer somewhere directly through the wireless interface to your PlayStation. So I think we'll see a lot more of that in the future.
Yeah. And what do you look? I mean, the movies that like Xbox offers, because they also sell movies in the Xbox Live Marketplace. But my sense is that it's like very oriented to like the 14-year-old to 20-year-old demographic. It's like every superhero movie and slasher pick that you could possibly want to watch.
Netflix is now on the Xbox.
Oh, are they?
They're actually doing HD movie streaming to the Xbox 360. Uh-huh. So that's another box.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how many like documentaries you could buy on that marketplace.
Well, it's Netflix catalog.
Oh, right. Right. I just meant you know, that will probably overtake, I guess, whatever service Microsoft built.
Hmm. That's interesting. Do you license the stuff that your filmmakers have to Netflix, and do you, or does the filmmaker do that directly?
We don't do Netflix.
You don't do Netflix.
Why is that? It has to do with a volume of sales. You know, we're a very niche market because of the type of content we have. You know, for Hollywood type movies, narrative feature films, sort of Michael Moore style documentaries, sure, I think that it makes sense. But, you know, we're very, we've got this very kind of niche content arena, and that's not really where we're looking to build our customer base through Netflix.
Do you kind of see the Reframe site as the way to go for doing that?
I don't know yet. You know, like I said, we... originally, we didn't need all of the services that Reframe was set up to serve. They're originally were approaching very traditional distributors who were still distributing maybe in film and tape,
right?
And had a lot of back catalog that was just falling out of, you know, customers couldn't access it anymore. And so they were offering the possibility of digitizing a distributor's whole catalog, moving it from tape or film to DVD, and then also streaming. And the way they set it up, though, is that it was kind of like a Chinese menu. You could take one from column A and two from column B. And since we already had our entire catalog authored on DVD in-house, it's one of the services we provide our filmmakers, is we do all the authoring, design, all of that for them. We didn't need any of that stuff. All we wanted was that streaming capability. So it took about a year breaking down their contract and getting them to agree, yes, you can, we'll service you for only that, only the streaming. So that's what we're using Reframe for, only the streaming.
So you're kind of testing your audience for streaming too, with this.
Well, we tested it with the Google, we thought was a good test, and it looked very promising. So now we'll see if it worked, if the numbers kind of, you know, come out the same. We'll see.
I know it's getting to be 1:30, and I know we promised we'd end. It's 1:25, so this went very quickly. And I don't know. One of the things I'd hoped that we could explore was exactly what we might do very specifically for Boston. We didn't get there, but maybe there's a way of continuing this conversation again. And making links to one another somehow, so that we can figure out some ways that we can, you know, bring the producing community to, I don't know, to some of the services that some of you might offer. Maybe there's a way of, for example, putting together a whole Boston package of filmmakers. There would be enough of them, you know, to meet your 20, for example. I don't know, but these are conversations we could continue, I hope.
You could have the Boston Baked Beans chat.
The big theme.
It's great for everyone to meet one another. And I don't know if you want to, you know, maybe we can do this again in the spring or whatever, and follow up.
I think Jim has heard me say this before, but like the interesting thing that you have in Boston and maybe in San Francisco and not in a whole lot of other places is you have, you know, a filmmaking community and a technology community, and so it's interesting when you get the two of them, the two of those things together, you know, LA, New York, you know, lots of filmmakers, but not a lot of the sort of new technology, new distribution thinking. Mm-hmm. So I do think there's a lot of potential, and, you know, I know Making Media Now kind of does that every year, but, I feel like there's opportunity to do it.
Yeah, maybe we should get some of the entrepreneurs and the media companies that are actually developing stuff maybe more involved in the conversation and get them more involved in the Making Media Now conference.
Yes, which is June 5th this year. Just to make a little plug. But I also wanted to make a plug for NAMAC because we really want to involve the whole media arts community in the planning of the NAMAC conference, which is coming in August. So we really hope to be in touch with all of you around that. We're planning a lot of ancillary activities that we want people involved in.
Would people be willing to come back again, say, in February, March, as we approach, you know, coming closer towards the time of Making Media Now? Sort of, we can get an update from you, we can sort of see where people are. Maybe we can start to pull some ideas together for, you know, what things that people have. And just touch base, we'll bring lunch again. And
we could also use the video and the conversation as a kind of a sneak preview of the conference and to promote the conference.
Yes.